Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. It has been quite the week of varied topics on this program thus far. We've discussed women's health, conspiracy theories, and the intersection of mental health and gun violence. And today, we're going to leave the human race behind and instead spend some time talking about the most abundant life form on our planet, the insect. Today's show is all about appreciating insects for the varied ways they live their lives. So I will ask that you set aside any questions you may have about extermination. That's a subject we can and will address on another day. Instead, if you are curious about a particular insect, you can call or email us with a description and we'll try to identify it and talk about it with the help of our guest, May Birenbaum, professor of entomology and the head of the entomology department at the University of Illinois School of Integrative Biology. May Birenbaum, welcome back to Focus.
Always a pleasure.
Glad to have you with us. To join us on air with your questions about all manner of insects, from bees to beetles to bugs to butterflies to ants, spiders, cockroaches, what else?
Web spinners, gladiators, there are all kinds of obscure orders. We can go on. There's about 900,000 species of described insects, so we only have an hour.
All right, so maybe we should stop listing now. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or share your description of that particular insect that's caught your eye on Facebook or Twitter, though I imagine it might take more than 140 characters to describe it, but you certainly can find us on either site at Focus580. I cannot believe this Saturday is the 30th Insect Fear Film Festival.
Yeah, we were very optimistic in 1984 when we called the first one the first annual Insect Fear Film Festival because we really had no idea if we'd even make it to number two when here we are 30 years later.
What was the impetus for starting this?
I had the idea as a graduate student. I was at Cornell, I was walking on the campus and saw a sign advertising a showing of Godzilla sponsored by the Asian Student Association. And I thought, well, if Asian students can have a sense of humor about their identity, why can't entomologists? So I thought we could show insect fear films and through the entomology department. So I approached the head of the department, and he thought it was too undignified, and we could maybe show insect documentaries, and that was not the idea at all. So I kind of shelved the idea until I came here as an assistant professor, spent a couple years establishing my scientific credentials, and pitched the idea to my department head, and he thought it was splendid, and here we are 30 years later.
What are some of your favorite insect fear films that you have shown through the years?
Well, I think my all-time favorite has to be one that we featured at our 20th festival. And there are many reasons it's my favorite. It's called Beginning of the End. It's a 1957 film written, directed, produced by Burt I. Gordon, who is known in Hollywood as Mr. Big, not only because his initials are B-I-G, but because throughout the 50s, most of his films involved oversized organisms of various descriptions.
All right, okay.
And among them, in Beginning of the End, it's giant radiation-induced grasshoppers that are produced by an experiment that goes awry in Rantoul's USDA lab. They're trying to develop giant vegetables to solve world hunger, and grasshoppers get in, and they in turn become enormous. So there's a local angle. In fact, it's the whole film starts with a road sign with directions to Champaign-Urbana, and Champaign-Urbana police calling Rantoul. And eventually, these grasshoppers break out of a warehouse in Ludlow, march through the suburbs of Paxton, and end up in Chicago, climbing the Wrigley Building and marching down the Magnificent Mile, and spoiler alert, drowning in Lake Michigan.
Oh.
So it was great fun to have the producer, director, and writer here, even though he was in his 80s and had not made a film in many years. And, you know, we typically kind of make fun of the science in these films. It was hard. There's nothing we could make fun of that Burt I. Gordon himself wasn't responsible for, since he wrote, directed, produced, and did the special effects for this film. And we had a Q&A, and I was actually delighted at how with what poise he handled the questions. One of the things that strike Central Illinois audiences immediately is the fact that in many of the scenes, there are mountains in the background.
Yeah. Well, so, they film so many movies. They film in California, and they're supposed to be taking place in Cairo or something
well,
like that.
This one, it just doesn't clearly, mesh. This was clearly not Paxton. In fact, to my knowledge, Paxton doesn't have suburbs. So in fact, Mr. Gordon was asked, what about all those mountains? And without missing a beat, he said, there's a lot of road construction. That was just fun. Good for him. So, and, you know, I had all kinds of interesting stories. The special effects were pretty amateurish. He ordered giant lubber grasshoppers, and not knowing that they're cannibalistic. So by the time he got around to shooting the climactic drowning scene in Lake Michigan, there were like a dozen grasshoppers is all he could muster. So you know, a dozen grasshoppers in a pan of water. It's a classic.
Wow.
For many reasons.
That's quality filmmaking right there. Do you find these films have helped people who tend to develop an appreciation of the insect world? Have you come across anybody that sort of, as a result of even something, you know, as, you know, like an arachnophobia or something like that, that films that really highlight the insect, even in sometimes silly ways, can allow people to more seriously take a look at that world?
Well, that's one of the goals of our festival. And in addition to the films, we have an hour of kind of meet and greet, if you will, sort of opportunity for people to see the real insects, you know, the stars of the film not in person, but in exoskeleton, I guess.
Right.
We have this year, for example, since we'll be showing War of the Coprophages, which is an episode of The X-Files, it features cockroaches, we'll have a exotic cockroach petting zoo, which is not something every town can boast of.
No, no.
And that, more than anything, helps allay fears. Sort of, yeah. Knowledge is power. And alerting people to what the reality is often goes a long way toward building, if not affection, then at least respect.
Well, and you do a petting zoo like that just about every year, right?
Right.
With different types. And cockroaches are featured, right, I guess, in that episode.
But we'll also have non-insect scorpions and tarantulas. Pretty sure we have a couple of millipedes. We have some lubber grasshoppers, some pretty hefty grasshoppers, and the usual assortment of arthropod diversity.
As you mentioned, The X-Files is featured prominently this year. We spoke earlier this week with Chris Carter, the creator of The X-Files, who will be participating in this year's film festival.
Much to my amazement. You know, for our anniversary dates, 20, 25, 30, I've tried very hard to get a star, as it were.
Right.
And not surprisingly, not many Hollywood people are that interested in coming to a public university in central Illinois in February for very little other than the adulation of the crowds.
Right.
But I took a chance, and X-Files was ripe for featuring because at least 9 of the episodes revolve around insects, and one of the 2 feature films in the franchise, a central plot element involves insects. So that was certainly the content for a festival, and took a chance, sent the letter, and much to my shock and amazement, not only this is a news flash, not only is Chris Carter coming, the creator, writer, producer, director of the series, but Darren Morgan, the scriptwriter for the episode War of the Coprophages, is actually coming as well. So this is fantastic.
And for those who don't know, you have buried the lead a little bit with War of the Coprophages. This particular episode of The X-Files featured an entomologist named Birenbaum.
Yeah, I first found out about Dr. Bambi Barenboim when I was looking at TV Guide, and I saw that the X-Files episode featured a character named Dr. Bambi Barenboim. I was surprised because the name was spelled exactly the same way I spell my name, and not even all my relatives spell it the same way. So, of course, I watched the episode. The phone was ringing off the hook because it turns out Bambi Barenboim is a USDA entomologist. So Dr. Bambi Barenboim, and not only is she a USDA entomologist who helps Mulder investigate a mysterious wave of cockroach-related deaths, but she is, in the words of Darren Morgan, the scriptwriter, a luscious babe. So
clearly a doppelganger, without question.
I'm afraid I live up to every stereotype anyone ever had about entomologists, including the thick glasses here and complete lack of fashion sense, But Bambi Barenboim was a real step forward in the image of entomologists in stage and screen. So thank you, Darren Morgan and Chris Carter.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is May Birenbaum, professor of entomology at the University of Illinois, the real one. We are previewing this year's Insect Fear Film Festival. We're also discussing the wonderful world of insects. A reminder, on today's show, we are setting aside questions of extermination. Instead, we are taking the hour to appreciate insects for the varied ways they live their lives. And if you are curious about a particular insect, you can call or email with a description, and May Birenbaum will try to identify it. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or comments on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. And we will start this morning with Alice in Champaign. Good morning, Alice.
Good morning. I just have a quick question. What is the difference between a chrysalis and a cocoon?
Ah, good question. And it's amazing how many people, including writers of children's books, don't know that. A chrysalis is a term that's used to describe a pupa, and a pupa is that intermediate stage between the larva, the immature, and the adult. And this pupal stage is characteristic only of insects in which metamorphosis or development proceeds from an immature stage that looks nothing like the adult. So baby grasshoppers look just like adult grasshoppers, only they don't have wings. About 90% of all insects, however, the immature stages have a completely different appearance, lifestyle, everything. Body parts are all different. So the pupal stage is really important for reorganizing all those tissues and actually building wings for the first time. So a chrysalis is kind of a popular name for a pupa. You can call that form a pupa no matter what the taxonomic identity of the insect is. Chrysalis is usually used to describe a butterfly pupa. Now, not butterflies, but many moths will spin a silken wrapper around that pupa, and that is a cocoon. Other insects and other orders will also spin a silken wrapper. So the cocoon, technically, is the silken wrapper. It is not the pupa inside. If you open up a cocoon, you'll find a chrysalis, or if it's a butterfly, or a pupa, if it's most other insects with complete development inside. So people, and especially in kids' books, use those terms interchangeably. And it, for me, it's kind of, if there's no silk, there's no cocoon. So I guess that's the difference.
So thank you. That's exactly why this came up. We were studying insects with my children, and I couldn't find the answer.
Well, it's incredible how often they're used, you know, as if they're the same, and they're not. So
thanks
for asking.
Much.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Dave in Champaign. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's your question for May Birenbaum?
Well, I was on a bird-watching trip in Costa Rica when I saw what appeared at first to be a hummingbird.
Ah.
On closer inspection with my binoculars, it looked a lot more like a very large moth.
Yep. In fact, almost...
I never knew what I was looking at.
Almost assuredly, that is what is sometimes called a hummingbird hawk moth, or in the family Sphingidae. These are large-bodied moths with very long tongues and very very good flight abilities. Just like a hummingbird, they can hover. They tend to be crepuscular. They come out at dusk or at night. And just like hummingbirds, they will hover and sip nectar from flowers, particularly flowers that hang down. And very, very often people mistake the hawk moths for the hummingbirds, because they're built the same, they move the same, and they have much of the same ecology, because, you know, they like to feed on nectar, and the timing's a little different. But it's kind of a shocker when I've been fooled, actually, wondering what the heck are hummingbirds doing out at, you know, dusk. But then they're hawk moths. And I just like to put in a word, you don't even have to go to Costa Rica or anywhere exotic to see these fantastic creatures, because right here, if you grow tomatoes in your garden and you see that 4-inch caterpillar that's munching on the leaves, that's called a tomato hornworm or tobacco hornworm. And it turns into a hawk moth as an adult.
Okay. And are they as large as the species that are in Costa Rica?
Yeah, actually, they can be the same size as or even bigger than hummingbirds.
Wow.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Thank you. So how big can moths get?
The largest wingspan on a moth is about 20 inches. There are two contenders. It kind of depends on how you measure whether you want to take body weight into what's the world's largest moth. But there's a Thysania species in Central America. It's kind of a drab brown mottled sort of moth with about a 20-inch wingspan. And then there's the Atlas moths of Asia. And they're a little more spectacular looking, with sort of russet colors and eye spots, and they're heavier bodied too, and so they can get pretty big.
When you say wingspan, you're talking about from the end of one wing,
the tip of one to the
tip of the other. Uh-huh. Wow, that's very big.
They are very big, and in fact, those giant the Atlas moths are in the family giant silk moths, and some of those. Speaking of cocoons, they spin silk in cocoons, and that silk is used just like Japanese silkworm silk. Not so much in international trade, but the silk from the giant silk moth cocoons can be used to make fabric, just like the silk of the much smaller Bombyx mori, the domestic silkworm of sericulture.
Does the silk take on the same basic properties, or is it thicker?
Nothing really beats the domestic silkworm for silk production. Among other things, the silk is white. It's unpigmented. And a lot of other silkworms produce yellow pigment, so it doesn't take dyes as well. The Bombyx mori spins a single thread that's a half mile long to make this cocoon. And often the other species will, you know, that's a tough act to follow there. Yeah. A lot of them will just make sort of shorter segments. So it's useful if you can unreel in a single thread. You can do a lot more with it that way. The properties of the silk of Bombyx mori, they're astonishing. I mean, it is incredibly strong. A silken cable can sustain a weight greater than a steel cable of the same dimension, but it's elastic and steel is not, so it can stretch 50% of its length or more. Yeah. It's lustrous. It's a good insulator. It takes dyes. It's crease resistant. It's incredible stuff. And part of the reason the giant silk moth cocoons can't compete is that the domestic silkworm is basically a creation of human domestication. It does not exist in the wild. It could not exist without us. If humans went extinct, only a handful of insects would care. Two of which are body lice and crab lice, because they have no other meals. Head lice and body lice are the same species, so they'd starve. Nobody would cry about that, but then we'd be gone, wouldn't we?
Yeah.
But Bombyx mori could not make it on its own. They depend on us.
And there goes our silk ties.
And there go the silk ties.
Along with the people. All right, let's next go to Steve in Urbana. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I have a question about dung beetles.
Dung beetles?
Yes, I was just reading a study that they can apparently navigate
by
sunlight during the day. And if it's a dark night, they can actually navigate by stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, that's been... I saw that news story. Then this celestial navigation has not been documented in that many species, but it's clear that the dung beetles, the dung rolling beetles, there are a lot of different kinds of dung beetles. There are dung beetles that basically bury the dung that they find in place, but the most spectacular are the species that are dung rollers. So they'll find a dung pat and they'll carve it up into round balls, and then they'll roll it away, because if you leave it where you find it, then every other dung beetle in town is going to try to fight you over it. So that's why they have to roll these things. And there's a recent study that demonstrated this daytime navigation and polarized light, and then also celestial navigation by moon and stars. So, yeah, people are underestimate insects, but they have capabilities that we just do not have. I mean, bees, for example, can also navigate by polarized light and the position of the sun. And I think the ultimate irony was the time when I was asked to go to Decatur to talk to, I think they were master gardeners, about the magnificent migratory flight of the monarch butterfly, which can fly over 1,000 miles to one specific area in Michoacán, Mexico, in the mountains, in Oyamel forests, where all monarchs from the eastern U.S. overwinter. And I got lost. Here are these monarchs. They don't have GPS. They don't have maps. They can find Michoacán. I couldn't find Decatur.
Wow. I guess how do they know this stuff?
Well, the monarchs are still kind of a mystery. It appears to involve sort of geomagnetic perception. The monarch genome has just been sequenced, and people are hoping to get some hints into this navigation ability. But some of the insects have astonishing navigation skills. There are desert ants that if you see where these desert ants live, there's absolutely no landmarks. It's a trackless wasteland. And yet they are unerringly good at returning to their nest from considerable distances. And that's been a subject of intense investigation, too. So
it has to be genetic, you think?
Likely a genetic template, but certainly it's modified by experience. That's one reason the monarch genome was such a high priority for sequencing, because this has been a lingering question as to how these monarchs who have never been to this overwintering site manage to find it every year. Jury's still out on that one, though.
Well, thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
Thanks very much for the call. Who needs a GPS if you've got a monarch? Next up is a listener from the central Illinois town of Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Ms. Berenbaum.
Oh, hi.
We spoke the last time, last summer, and we were talking about the lac bug. And we were talking about how they produce the basic ingredient for shellac, which is dissolved in alcohol. Mm-hmm. But the thing we didn't mention, I just recently found this out, that of all the lac bugs, it takes a huge amount of them to make what we use all over the world.
Yep.
But it's only the females that produce it.
Right. Well, the adult males are actually wimpy little guys that they have their job. They're vastly outnumbered. The ratio, male to female sex ratio in lac insects, is like 5 to 10,000 to 1. The female lac bug adult lacks most features, insect features. Mostly she is covered with this resinous secretion. The male's job is just to walk a few feet and find a female. And it's not very hard when your ratio is 10 to 1. And then that's it, and he dies. So you're absolutely right. It's the work of the female. So many of the benefits we get from the insect world are the work of females, like honey and wax, just the girls. So.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. Have you ever pet a cockroach? If you have been longing to, you will get that chance this weekend at the Insect Fear Film Festival. It's the 30th annual. We're talking with U of I entomologist Mae Berenbaum about this year's festival, as well as other topics related to the insect world. We welcome your questions about the insect world. Maybe there's a particular insect you're curious about and would like to learn more about, something you've seen around your house, in your garden, somewhere out in nature. Give us a call. You can email us, post your description on social media, and Mae Berenbaum will try to identify it. Here's how to do all of that. Call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu or post your questions or insect descriptions on Facebook or Twitter. We are on both sites at Focus 580. Let's get back briefly to the X-Files episode that you will be featuring that Darren Morgan wrote. And again, he'll be there at the Insect Fear Film Festival, not just for the screening of this episode, but for a discussion afterwards, along with Chris Carter, the creator of the X-Files. In that, there were a number of issues and ideas from the insect world that were raised, and I thought it might be kind of fun to sort of walk through them and find out if there's truth in what was presented in the given episode. So, for example, there are references to anaphylactic allergic responses to cockroaches. Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, one of the leading contributors to asthma attacks among inner city children is exposure to cockroach allergens. So the principal components of dust that create allergies or responsible for allergic responses are shed skins, fecal matter, and other bits and pieces of cockroaches. And they're incredibly common in urban environments. And the sort of increase in asthma is linked to an increase in or a decrease in the amount of time kids spend playing outside, and also an increase in the integrity of buildings. There are fewer cracks and places for air to escape. And there are widespread incidences. The two major sources of allergens are in dust are cockroach and dust mite allergens. Just actually recently read that one of the proteins that is overexpressed in cases of allergic response is an enzyme that is like it's similar in its sequence to what's called a chitinase, and chitin is a sugar, a long chain polymer of smaller sugar units linked together, that is about half the weight of the exoskeleton of all insects, all arthropods.
Mm-hmm.
And we, believe it or not, have enzymes that can break down these chitinases. Some of them in our stomachs actually are active as chitinases and are thought perhaps to have remained functional because we have a long biological history of eating insects. But this allergic reaction is thought to be an overproduction or an overreaction on the part of the body to the presence of parasites in the body. Mm. So it was at one point, and in most people, it's an adaptive response. But when there's an overstimulation and a hyper response, then you end up with symptoms of asthma and anaphylactic shock. Mm. So, and this is, I know it's very disturbing, but this is a reason if you are allergic to chocolate, you probably shouldn't eat insects, because some of the chocolate allergies actually reflect the insect contaminants that are in chocolate. Yeah. So, and there are, I just read the FDA food defect action levels. The FDA publishes levels of insect contamination below which you can still sell the product and above which you can't. And it's staggeringly high for chocolate. It's like 60 parts per sample.
I don't want to hear this. Another reference in the show is to something called Ekbom syndrome.
Ekbom syndrome.
What
There's an entire episode about Ekbom syndrome. Ekbom syndrome is also known as delusory parasitosis or delusions of parasitosis. And this is a...
Where you feel like you have, like there are bugs in your body, right?
Exactly. It's a psychosis. People are convinced that they are infested with invisible insects. Yeah. And
I hope nobody is napping while listening to this show. You can just imagine the dreams going in the wrong direction. But go ahead.
Actually, that's a problem when entomologists go out to a restaurant. We end up talking about lice and dung and any of the people in the next table. They're always looking at us.
They're like, could you keep it down?
Yeah. But this is typical in middle-aged to older people, particularly those who live alone or have undergone some sort of major life trauma. And it is very serious because people in their desperation to rid themselves of these imaginary insects can do serious physical injury to themselves. People have, set their hair on fire with gasoline, and they have carved themselves up with razor blades. And actually, in the episode, there's a scene. One of the cockroach-related deaths involves kids who are cooking up dung. Coprophage, by the way, means dung eater, to get high off the methane fumes. And one of them, it's not clear whether or not his skin is there are actually cockroaches burrowing under his skin, or he just thinks they are. So that is, it's a real phenomenon, and it does show up in the plot there.
All right, let's take another call. We have Fran on the line from Oak Lawn. Hi, Fran.
Hi. Great show.
Thank you.
I had no idea you people were so far along analyzing in determining the genomes. I have for the longest time wondered, I've thought to myself while walking over my property, someday they're going to be able to, analyze, determine the genome of dandelions or cockroaches or whatever, And then they'll be able to develop countermeasures for disease-causing insects, kudzu. And,
oh, gosh, yep, we're there.
Hallelujah. talk to me about this.
Yeah, sure. Actually, the first insect genome to be sequenced, not surprisingly, was Drosophila melanogaster, the fruit fly of genetics fame, and that was back in 2000. And there's now launched right here on our campus, actually, by Gene Robinson, my colleague who's the director of the Institute for Genomic Biology, is what is called the I5K initiative. That's to sequence 5,000 insect genomes in 5 years because the price of sequencing has dropped so far. We here at the University of Illinois, Gene headed up the honeybee genome project, so the honeybee genome has been sequenced. Barry Pittendry, another colleague in my department, headed up the body louse genome project. So body louse genome has been sequenced. There are multiple mosquito genomes that have been sequenced in a couple of genera, the Anopheles, which is the malaria vector, and also Aedes species, which vector yellow fever. There are the pea aphid genome has been sequenced. There are Bombyx mori, the Japanese, the domestic silkworm genome has been sequenced. We here, actually, in my lab group, we're sequencing, this is not going to sound familiar, but the navel orange worm genome. This is a caterpillar that is the number one pest of almonds and pistachios in California. Very interesting insect. But, yeah, there are astonishing advances you can make by peeking into the genome.
I can't wipe the smile off my face. This is the sort of thing that should be on television in place of Dancing with the Stars.
I could not agree with you more. Absolutely, yeah. I think it's fascinating. The honeybee genome, for example, two big surprises out of the genome is compared to other insects, honeybees have very few genes for detoxifying poisons like pesticides and very few genes compared to other insects for dealing with disease organisms. And it's become clear that because of their social behavior, they have many behavioral ways to deal with toxins and diseases, just like us. In fact, when honeybees get infected with certain pathogens, they can raise the hive temperature to kill the pathogens. So they basically create a social fever. Which is astonishing.
It is. It's beautiful. Thank you.
Thanks
well,
for the
thank
call.
Thank you.
Bye.
My guest is May Birenbaum, professor of entomology at the University of Illinois and the driving force behind the 30th annual Insect Fear Film Festival. We've been discussing that. We welcome your questions, comments, observations about the wonderful world of insects. If you have come across something small and creepy and crawly or something tiny flying through the air and you'd like to know a little bit more about it, you can give us a call at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can also email your description to will-talk@illinois.edu, and we will take more of your calls after a short break. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We are discussing insects in all their glory with University of Illinois entomology professor May Birenbaum. Once again, a reminder, save your extermination questions for another day. This is the day to appreciate the most abundant form of life on our planet. Yes, even the cockroach deserves some appreciation. If you are curious about a particular insect, you can call or email with a description. May will try to identify it. You can call us at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. You can also share your thoughts on Facebook or Twitter. Find us on either at Focus580. I wanted to make sure we talked a little bit about something that we were sort of promoting in advance of the show. That's also a topic within the X-Files, and I think even within the one episode that you're showing, which is cyborg and robotic insects. I understand this, you know, once largely fictional concept, maybe is starting to become something more seriously considered, or maybe, in your view, ought to be?
Oh, absolutely. There are a number of recent papers, actually, that have come out featuring robotic insects, insect drones, cyborg insects, bug bots, beetle bots, and people for a long time tried to create these sort of little insects that little robots that were built like insects, among other things. The The alternating tripod insects have six legs and move them three at a time, mm-hmm. two on one side, one on the other. Very stable way of moving, so it's great for a robot.
So like a little camera or microphone to spy on people or something
right.
like that.
But what they tried to do for the long time is they had a human mindset and they tried to reconstruct an insect. Now they're actually creating these amalgams of living insects with robotic capabilities. So the robotics MIT professor in the episode, Dr. Ivanov, remarks that one of the problems with creating tiny little insect drones or cyborgs is they need an energy source. He talked about them for exploring extraterrestrial systems.
Mm-hmm.
They've now actually figured out you can't strap a battery pack on a tiny little
right.
insect,
right.
but they now have developed these means of putting little generators into the wing muscle, so every mechanical deformation generates energy that actually produces energy. There's another system that's out there that taps into the chemical energy that insects themselves use. They use a carbohydrate source called trehalose, and there's just a recent paper on it's called Insect Mountable Biofuel Cell with Self-Circulation System. That's an IEEE. So they've now made great strides in the 15 years since the episode aired in producing miniaturized part insect, part machine with a power source that maybe not get them to outer space. But the logic behind these guys is that they can not just spy on people, but you can send them into places where the conditions are not suitable for humans, and they can, by means of tiny cameras, send back information by atmospheric sensors, can tell you about levels of explosives and the like. So it is actually reality. So pretty amazing that this Dr. Ivanov was so prescient back then.
Okay, and we have to mention, if we're talking about the X-Files and the Insect Fear Film Festival, obviously we have to make some reference to aliens. It's only appropriate. And in fact, there is a connection, perhaps, between what people perceive as UFOs and, at least in your point of view, and maybe we're starting to hear some examples of this, insect swarms. Maybe that's what people tend to see when they report UFOs.
Well, that was Dr. Bambi Berenbaum's research project, actually.
Yeah.
Her hypothesis was that insect swarms. Insect is cuticle is a dielectric, so if it's manipulated or brushed, it can produce an electrical discharge or a coronal discharge. Sort of like ball lightning or a St. Elmo's fire. This was an idea advanced by Phil Callahan in 1978, and clearly Darren Morgan, the scriptwriter, read those papers.
Mm-hmm.
So this was debated in the literature and hadn't appeared recently in the literature, but the thesis was basically large swarms of insects, particularly moths that have scales that are dielectrics, can, at the right time of year or the right atmospheric conditions, generate glowing, pulsating lights. And insect swarms tend to be cohesive. Insects have a behavior of turning back inward when they reach the edge. So they form a shape. It may not be the saucer shape, but it's still a coherent shape over large distances. Locust swarms, for example, have shapes. So that every now and then there are reports in the news of a UFO that turn out to be probably insect swarms. And just last November, it happened in Denver, Colorado. A local news station was very excited about a UFO sighting. There was a military installation in Colorado Springs, not far away. They vehemently denied it was a special new form of
right.
spy plane. And the general consensus is that it was probably an insect swarm, although the reporter still sticks to her story that they were objects, they were flying, they weren't identified, and therefore they were a UFO.
So. All right. Let's take some more calls. We'll go next to Ron in Decatur. Hi, Ron.
Yes, good morning. Back years ago when I was a teenager, I used to be dabbling in entomology. I collected some Mantispidae of the
cool.
old Mantispidae. I got two of them, and I gave them both to the University of Illinois several years ago, and I've forgotten to write down the dates when I collected them. Do you know when these adults fly, what their immature forms feed on,
oh,
and their
huh.
range?
I can't tell you the the dates they fly, but their life cycle is truly bizarre. And in fact, when you donated to the University of Illinois, it was probably when one of the world's experts on mantispids was here, Dr. Ellis McLeod, and his student, Kurt Redborg. So they are in an order called Neuroptera, and they're called mantispids because they have grasping forelegs. They're called raptorial forelegs, like the mantis. They are predators. The most common one around here actually is striped like a Polistes wasp. Very strange creatures. They're immatures, however, develop in the respiratory system of spiders. They suck on the hemolymph, the blood of spiders, and develop internally. They don't kill the spiders, but they develop, they're parasites of those spiders. Very strange life cycle. And they're actually not that common. So
no, they're not common.
Kudos to you for finding them.
Yeah. So you don't know when the adults fly?
That I can't tell you. I'd have to look that up. And the books I've brought with me don't focus on the really obscure insects. But I'll... you know, you can send me an email after the show, and I will do my best to find it for you.
Or, I'd like to go out and see if I can get some more.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, thanks.
Sure thing.
Thanks for the call. Next up is Jill in Mackinac. Jill, good morning.
Good morning. Dr. Barenbaum, you mentioned the navel orange worm, the fact that it's a parasite of almonds.
Mm-hmm.
Since I'm a beekeeper, I have a vested interest in keeping the almond industry healthy.
Oh, yes.
Bees for pollination.
Yep.
So if you could give me a brief primer on the navel orange worm, I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Thanks.
Well, actually, California almonds are in the news because of the bees. Various and sundry problems with bees and beekeepers. Half of America's bees go to almonds in California in a two-week period in February to do all the pollination. And the almond growers cannot get enough bees this year. And 15 years ago, to rent a hive for pollination, about one hive, two hives per acre, $10 a hive, $15, is now up to $185 a hive for rental fees because there's no alternative right now. So the navel orange worm has a weird name. It's not that common in navel orange worm. If anything, it's the fallen navel orange worm. It feeds on fallen fruits and nuts, all kinds of fallen fruits and nuts. It's native to the western U.S. and Mexico. It probably has shifted onto all these crops because it feeds on them once they've fallen. The thing about the way almonds are grown, so they fall, and on the tree they split. And that's when the navel orange worm can get in. It can't penetrate the almond, which is basically built like a peach. It's in the peach family. So when it splits open, the navel orange worm can lay eggs, and the caterpillars feed on the inside. They continue to feed when it falls on the ground, but the growers leave them on the ground to dry. And same thing with pistachios, and they cause massive damage, enormous crop loss. And that's one of the reasons that insecticides are so commonly used in almond groves, ranches, orchards, whatever they're called, and pistachios. And that's the problem because these where almonds are grown, they are heavily, heavily treated with pesticides. Fungicides to prevent aspergillus fungus from getting into those cracked, opened, you know, split holes. Herbicides to prevent weeds from growing between the rows. Insecticides to keep navel orange worms and coddling moths out. Not so much coddling moths, but navel orange worms. Even rodenticides, because when those nuts are on the ground, rodents can come and eat them. So almonds are a real boon for the beekeeping industry because a huge rental, pollination now generates more income from beekeepers than honey does. But it's a tough life for a bee in an almond orchard, not a friendly place.
Speaking of bees, honeybees have been in the news recently.
There was a major... no pun intended, sting operation called Honeygate. Honest, I'm not making this up, that busted up a major honey laundering scheme. Again, not making this up, whereby unscrupulous honey importers were bringing in Chinese honey. And there's an import tariff on Chinese honey because the Chinese were dumping honey at below market prices and adulterating it. And it was contaminated, all kinds of problems. So Chinese honey, there are all kinds of restrictions on bringing it in, but it is transshipped. So millions of pounds of honey are sent elsewhere, relabeled and sent back to the U.S. And people have estimated they've avoided $180 million in these fees that would have been collected. And the government has taken this very seriously and just this week announced major arrests of the major violators, the $180 million anti-dumping fees, Project Honeygate. The first arrests were in 2008, actually involved importers up in Chicago. But this is U.S. Customs and Border Protection. 14 individuals have been charged. Honey Holding and Grobe Farms are the two of the nation's largest honey suppliers that were caught in this sting. And you can imagine the puns in the news stories going that Charles Schumer said, a successful sting operation sure to be a buzzkill for honey smugglers. Yeah, so gird yourself for the incoming flood of puns.
Well, in our final few minutes, let's see if we can knock out a few emails that have come in. Susan writes, she says, I noticed this butterfly yesterday on my windowsill inside. She says, she's thinking that eggs must have hitchhiked on the geranium or rosemary plants I brought inside in the fall and that are in the same window area.
That's the most likely hypothesis because there are, to my knowledge, no butterflies that overwinter inside houses in central Illinois. So that would be a reasonable scenario. I like to go to the farmer's market in the summer and buy the parsley and dill that have swallowtail eggs. Most people try to avoid those, but I actually like the butterflies. So it's entirely possible that there was a pupa in there somewhere.
Susan also says, somewhere I read or saw that human head and pubic lice have evolved from a common ancestor to be different species. When they split off is the clue to when humans lost hair on most of their bodies.
And started wearing clothing, actually, because body lice live in clothing. The recent genome sequence revealed that they are, in fact, one species, but different subspecies. They're indistinguishable in terms of their genome. But, yeah, there are two markers. There's when we lost our body hair and then when we started wearing clothing.
And Bev is curious to hear information about the camel spider.
The camel spiders. Yeah, they're actually not spiders. Those are the ones. There was an internet meme. It looked like it was 4 feet long, dangling from the grasp of an Iraqi, a U.S. military, a soldier in Iraq. It was actually a foreshortened. They're only about 5 inches or so. They're called sun spiders or sulfugids. They're arachnids, but not true spiders. But like spiders. They are predators of small crawling things. They do not, like the internet legends say, leap up at night and rip open the stomachs of camels and suck their blood. No, they do not. They're kind of camel-colored. That's the extent to which there's any camel connection.
We have just a minute left. I want to try and squeeze in one more call. Beth is in Champaign. Hi, Beth.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could talk a little about foreign grain beetles.
Well, there are a number of them. Do you mean the capra beetle?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
It's a little tiny, kind of oval-shaped, dark brown.
Yeah, that's a huge problem. About 10,000, 8 to 10,000 years ago, humans started growing crops and then producing surpluses, and then we tried to, then we could store them. And there is a whole suite of very small insects, many of which are beetles, that make a living on these stored grains. And they tend to be worldwide in distribution and cosmopolitan. We have flower beetles, which are little tiny ones. And keeping some of these grain beetles out is a major job of our of border security, actually. Capra beetles are among the largest challenges because they will eat anything, not just grains. They will eat drugs. They will eat spices and herbs. And they are periodically intercepted at various ports and in various shipments. And they can actually stop international trade and cause all kinds of issues because nobody wants them. Once they're established, there's no way to get rid of them. If there may be a beetle that is technically called the foreign grain beetle, but I don't know that common name. But capra beetles, I know, are continually being intercepted. They are native to India, that part of the world, and they are hugely problematical in shipments of grain all over the world.
We are out of time, but I want to give you a last second chance to make a quick pitch for the 30th annual Insect Fear Film Festival. So it'll
be Saturday, the 23rd. Doors open at 6 for activities, exhibits, hands-on petting, face painting, and the like. 7 o'clock is the introduction. I'll present a plaque of appreciation to Mr. Carter from 7:30 to 8:15. We will watch War of the Coprophages, the TV episode featuring USDA entomologist Dr. Bambi Berenbaum from 8:15 to 8:45. Chris Carter will answer questions. 8:45 to 10:45 will show the movie The X-Files Fight the Future. And again, he'll answer questions from 10:45 to 11:15. Entirely free. It's a unique form of entertainment you won't find anywhere else.
And this is Follinger Auditorium.
Follinger Auditorium on the campus. I hope to see you there.
May Berenbaum is a professor of entomology and heads the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. The 30th Annual Insect Fear Film Festival is Saturday. Details also on our website. May, thanks so much.
Oh, a pleasure. Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, in advance of the Academy Awards Sunday, we will talk about film and its role in public discourse. We will also then, in the second half of the show, have some news about Focus going forward, and I will be joined by Illinois Public Media's Jim Meadows and Focus producer Lindsay Moon. Hope you can tune in then. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.